Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. This is Financial Literacy Month. Woo-hoo! And we are continuing our focus on newcomers to Canada. Today, we're going to be talking about the importance of financial empowerment, what that means, and how to achieve it. Our guest is Andrea Federer. She's the Chief Marketing Officer at GoEasy. Then thinking about immigrating to Canada, it's going to cost you. The founder of immigration.ca, Colin Singer, is here to take us through some of the numbers. And, you know, for other Canadians who are not newcomers, it's a sobering look at just how privileged we are to already be here. Later, the emotional and financial toll of having a child with an illness can be an enormous, enormous cost to families. Our guest is Kate Horton. She is the CEO of Ronald McDonald House Charities Canada, and she's going to be here to provide some context on what that cost actually looks like in dollars and cents. Plus, why we take financial risks. It might just be how the human brain works. Elise Paysan-Lenestour is an associate professor of finance at the University of South Wales, and she will be here with findings from her research. Moolala's focus on Financial Literacy Month is made possible thanks to our sponsors. So Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Easy Financial, personal home and home equity and auto loans. Indeed Canada, the number one job site worldwide. Canadian Bankers Association, the voice of more than 60 domestic and foreign banks, and Achieve, a leading charity that delivers employment, newcomer, and inclusion services in the Greater Toronto Area. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. Financial Literacy Month. Yes, it's Financial Literacy Month, and hooray for that. However, there is another related concept, and one that I think puts us to a much higher standard when it comes to helping people get a handle on their money. And that's the phrase financial empowerment. So we're going to talk about what that phrase actually means and how to support that, how to fuel that, how to foster that, in particular with newcomers to Canada. Our guest is Andrea Federer. She is the Chief Marketing Officer of GoEasy. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Absolutely thrilled to be here today talking about a topic that I'm very, very passionate about. So thank you so much for having us on air.
It is our pleasure. And when you think of that word or phrase, rather, what does the phrase financial empowerment mean to you?
So I think it's a great question, Bruce. And where I would sort of start is the difference between what I believe is financial literacy and financial empowerment. And I think a lot of people today talk about financial literacy. Financial Literacy Month, as an example. But when I think about financial empowerment, to me, it's really about the ability not just to provide education around personal finances, but also to ensure that people have the tools and resources to change their behavior for the long term. So to me, it's not just about reading an article or seeing a video. It's about really making sure that people understand what they need to do to get ahead of their finances, to change behaviors that might have gotten them into a certain situation, and figure out what they can do to get past that situation to really have more financial freedom and a better financial future.
We have a shared value in supporting newcomers in particular at this time of year. Canadians all the time, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But in this moment, we're talking about newcomers. What is the same for and different for newcomers when it comes to fostering financial empowerment?
So I think the big thing for newcomers is really trying to figure out how to navigate the system. And if you think about a newcomer who comes to this country, financial empowerment and understanding the finance system is just one part of what they have to do in this new country. And so I think what often happens is they're very overwhelmed by trying to find work, find somewhere to live. And so trying to understand what it means to actually navigate the financial system sometimes takes a back seat beyond the basics. And so I think it's our responsibility as a country, as a nation, to be sure that we can educate those people around how to best navigate the system so that they don't make any mistakes early on that can really kind of cost them downstream.
You've done a survey on newcomers, and I want to get to that in a second. But before we do, I'm going to ask a question that is probably on the minds of some, if not many, of our listeners. And that is, Wait a second. Easy Financial lends money to people, and the interest they charge is not 0.001%. In fact, it's an interest rate that is higher than they would receive at if they were able to get a personal loan at a bank. How do you address the questions or the concerns about the integrity or the credibility of your focus on financial empowerment, given that the business you work in makes money from people who could be, it'd be beneficial if they were systemically addicted to the products and services that you sell?
So it's a great question, Bruce. And I think I would answer that in a few ways. I think the first way is Easy Financial plays a fundamental role in the financial system. So if you look at the role that banks play, they in fact decline anybody that has a credit score of under 720. The number of people in our country who are considered non-prime and have a credit score under 720 is over 8 million Canadians.
Wow.
Now, one of the things that people don't necessarily understand is that the way that people build their credit is by actually taking out credit. Because when you have payments that report to the credit bureau, what happens is they're able to build their credit over time as those payments report to the bureau and they make on-time payments. So in a situation where a customer can't get approved from the bank, they would actually have no other way to be able to build their credit because they would be able to access the credit that they need to actually start that process of building. So I think the number one thing that we do as an organization is provide access to the over 8 million non-prime Canadians that are declined and denied access for credit by the banks every single day. The other thing, though, that we do differently is the fact that our whole goal and our whole mission as a business is to graduate our customers back to prime lending. So much so that 60% of our customers rebuild their credit over time, over 12 months of taking out a loan with us. But more importantly, 1 in 3 actually graduate to prime credit within that 12 months. So the reason why that's important is because we don't want our customers to be customers forever. We want to get the customers into the system, give them that second chance, give them that leg up to really rebuild their credit, and then ultimately see them get to that bank rate. So that's really what our goal and our mission is as an organization.
I highlighted this survey that you fielded that focused on newcomers. Tell us about some of the results that came through in that survey.
Yeah, so I think the reason why we did it is kind of twofold. One is when you look at the volume of newcomers coming into this country every year, it's over 500,000. And so we know that there's a consistent influx of new Canadians, and new Canadians are really fueling the growth of our country and such an important part of the fabric of our society. So there's definitely a huge amount of people that are coming in. The other thing that we knew is that there's tons of barriers that exist for people to actually understand the financial system here, whether it's language, whether it's resources, whether it's information, understanding what to trust. So we knew that there was a need here to actually get some more data points and really truly understand what is going on for new Canadians. And we knew that there was a problem, but I don't know, Bruce, that we knew was as bad as it is. And one of the key things that we found was that only 1 in 5 of newcomers to Canada after being here for 2 years feel comfortable in the financial system and understanding how to navigate it. I mean, that's astonishing after being here for 2 years. So that really highlighted the need for us to focus specifically on content and financial empowerment materials that would help this cohort specifically.
You've been a big supporter of Credit Canada's initiatives in that regard, in particular around the e-learning that we've developed in multiple languages, really trying to get at the credit score piece. Why do you think those messages are so hard for newcomers to, it's not understand, because it's not about just, you know, like it's not that complex a topic, but for them to then take action on? Is it language? Is it culture? Is it just they've never read the material before in the past? Why do you think that is?
So I think it's definitely the two things that you referenced. I think language is a big barrier. And I think definitely having the content in a multitude of languages, as you've done, is really, really important to ensure that we can talk to people in their language. And it really breaks down any barriers because they feel much more comfortable. And if you think about somebody who's new to this country, there's a lot of feelings of discomfort. And I think anything that we can do to make the situation more comfortable for them then makes it easier for them to ingest the information. So I think language is definitely a big barrier. And then I think cultural norms are also a big barrier, right? Every country in the world has different views of credit, has different views of debt, has different views of how to use cash. And I think adjusting to that in this country is really, really difficult. And you don't get that, Bruce, from a textbook, right? That's somebody's lived experience being in this country and really trying to understand it as they go through all of these processes of opening a bank account, renting an apartment, et cetera, et cetera. So I think those two things play a massive role in why it's not as quote unquote easy as one would think.
A big challenge for any lender, but I'd say perhaps more so for Easy Financial, given that you don't have deposits on the other end of your ledger, is how you price risk, how you determine what the human in front of you can be trusted to, based on the math, trusted to repay on what time. Credit scores are not something that newcomers will have because they haven't been in the Canadian system long enough. Tell us about some of the ways that you're trying to overcome that hurdle.
Yeah, so one of the big things that we're doing is we're looking at a partnership with Nova Credit. Nova Credit is a company that's new to Canada, and their whole view is that they want to make sure that if somebody has built up great credit in their country of origin, that could follow them to the new country that they come at. Because you have somebody who's been in their country of origin for years, might have a great credit score, but they come here and they're starting from scratch. So the question became, hey, how can we actually leverage all the information and data we have about them from their country of origin in this country to give them a head start and ensure that they're not starting from ground zero? So that partnership, I think, is going to be really, really key in how we start to manage that credit risk associated with newcomers. The other piece that I would say is around our product suite. So one of the things that we're trying to do is consistently think about how do you expand our products to make sure that they can meet the widest variety of customer needs, including those that are new to Canada. So we know that they have different needs than maybe somebody who owns a home in the country and can get a home equity loan. And so we're very much attuned to what their product needs are as it relates to those specific financial services that we offer.
Interesting. We've had Misha from Nova Credit on the show. It's an interesting model. I hope it catches on. As we wrap up here, I want to ask you for your biggest piece of advice that you would provide to newcomers to enable themselves to foster financial empowerment. There's so much for us to do in terms of lenders and nonprofits and immigrant services and all those. The ecosystem needs to do more, but there is also a role for the newcomer to play. What is your number one thing you would recommend that they do?
So I think the number one thing is really to get trusted advice and guidance. I think there is so much information out there that can be highly, highly overwhelming. But when you're able to get that information from a trusted source, I think it really gives credibility to what the individual is going to do. And I think it makes it much more simple. So whether that's somebody in the community that's been here for some time, whether that's somebody from Easy Financial that is from your same country of origin working in one of our branches, whether that's somebody from the community center, I think there's multiple ways for them to get that information. But ensuring that it comes from a trusted source, I think, is really important. Because where people get overwhelmed is just this consistent inundation of information that puts them on multiple paths, and you start to lose focus. And when you lose that focus, it almost becomes too difficult to take that first step. So I think making sure that they get trusted information so that they can take that first step and start to see the fruits of their labor and the benefits of actually doing that is really important.
That's great. Thank you for that, Andrea. The other trusted resource I'd say is the FCAC, the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. Do a search for that. They've got a tremendous amount of insight and knowledge and articles on all things money. Andrea Federer, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce. Have a great day.
Andrea Federer is the Chief Marketing Officer of GoEasy. Coming up next on Moolala, immigration lawyer Colin Singer is here to tell us how much it actually costs to immigrate to Canada. The number will surprise you. And later, why we take financial risks. Elise Paysan-Lenestour is a researcher and associate professor at the University of New South Wales. She'll be here with her scientific view of what's going on inside the human brain. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca. That's the website where much of the content lives. You can listen to past episodes on the site itself. You can search by topic, by guest name. You can also go back to the podcast platforms. All of them enable you to listen to a podcast by episode. You can download the full show. You can write a review. And you could even subscribe.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah Law, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. We have been talking a lot during Financial Literacy Month about newcomers to Canada and the financial challenges, the barriers, the solutions to life once they arrive here. In this conversation, we want to address another aspect, and that is what happens before they arrive here and get settled and all that. Because, of course, that is an additional cost. And I'm just talking the plane fare to get them from where they were to arriving in a Canadian city. To have that conversation, we are joined by Colin Singer. He is an immigration lawyer and founder of immigration.ca. He also hosts the podcast My Great Canada. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what are some of the things that a newcomer to Canada needs to prepare themselves for in terms of the costs?
So the biggest pool of candidates are what we call the high skilled applicants to Canada. And of course, Canada tries to bring in people who converse well in one of our official languages and have education which transfers seamlessly to our Canadian system. And of course, there's medical exams and application fees. So, I mean, every applicant in the broad pool of about 120,000 applicants on the federal side, add in another 120,000 on the provincial side. So about 250,000 people coming to Canada, maybe even a little bit more, closer to 300,000, would have to, in addition to a language test, having their education evaluated. A cost for an individual on a language test, for example, is $350, and an education credential is $200. And then you've got biometrics, and then, of course, there's these medical exams for everyone in the family. And then there's the application fee, and there's all kinds of different elements. But if you looked at a family of four in a highly skilled professional category, you're looking at close to $6,000 Canadian. Of course, that doesn't include the so-called settlement funding. And applicants coming to Canada have to show that they can absorb the first 6 months of getting used to coming and settling in Canada. And so they have to show, a family of four has to show $25,000 liquid in a bank account with a six-month highway, historical highway. So, I mean, you're looking at it's not cheap. They don't have to spend that money, but they have to have access to that $25,000. Many people borrow that fund or call it not. They get it gifted to them because you have to take off your debts. So you're looking at about $6,000 in soft costs to get into Canada. Plus, you got to have another $25,000 sitting in a bank. That doesn't include the airfare, of course, and that doesn't include the professional fees that many people want to subscribe to.
I had to do some visa work for work in the U.S. and retained one of your peers for that service for support in that service. Right. It was thousands of dollars. So when you think about a newcomer leaving their country, coming here, what do they need to factor in terms of the immigration lawyer if they choose to retain one? And I guess a lot of people would probably try and navigate the system themselves, but for those who would retain someone like you for their for support, what would that look like?
A typical fee for a family of four would be in the range of $3,000 Canadian, somewhere in that range, $3,000, $3,500. bear in mind, there are different levels of professionals that you can engage. There are licensed consultants, and then there are licensed attorneys. And lawyers and attorneys obviously present a premium of sorts because of the formation that goes in. But an experienced attorney generally would charge about $3,500 in the legal fees for an application like this.
I have heard that in their home country, there is a real business for those trying to make money, make a living, supporting newcomers to Canada, providing them with what they need to do to hop on that plane and have the highest probability of success in this country. I see both the merits of that specialization, and I also feel like I have a concern about that because I don't know how well regulated it is. What's your sense for the quality of those services that an immigrant would receive before they depart?
The literature is out there. There's demographics out there on the success level of an attorney versus a consultant. So Ottawa has gotten into the licensing game many years ago. They started in 2003. They've had three incarnations of terminating the regulatory body that was in play in 2003, then 2011, and now 2022. The third one came in. Each incarnation, it was an attempt to address failures in the previous system of regulation. The volume of complaints against immigration consultants is in the many thousands. And Ottawa has tried to improve, but I don't have a lot of faith in their ability to manage complaints. There's also there's this large pool of unlicensed consultants where they will offer someone an option to choose an immigration consultant or do it yourself, you know, do it yourself unlicensed, and there'll be a significant fee difference. So there's this unregulated pool of professionals, so-called, who don't have the licensing. And unfortunately, you know, it's a very wild, wild west market. But people who do their research can find a really competent and professional attorney where the demographics show if you hire a lawyer, your chances for success are going to be improved over a consultant.
We talked about that highly skilled newcomer who brings credentials and experience that the Canadian economy wants and needs. There are also a lot of newcomers who don't present with all those glorious attributes. They may be seeking asylum. They may be refugees. There may be really horrendous circumstances that they are leaving at home. How does the cost framework work for them? Because I would bet they don't have $6,000 plus $25,000 on arrival to prove that they're going to be able to fund their life. How does that work for them?
Well, to be candid with you, the biggest pool of immigrants to Canada are the highly skilled, and then the family class. In like medical profession or accounting, the people who really specialize in the refugee and humanitarian and compassion field really know their field well. And it's not a field that I'm particularly, our firm over the years has not really moved into that space. It really requires a different skill set completely. So I would say there are people who are in the asylum space who hire very, very competent attorneys and pay thousands of dollars. But the masses of people who qualify for help, they can access that help online or through intermediaries in, you know, Syria, for example. And there are pathways for Syrians and Ukrainians and such to get into Canada under these humanitarian for no cost at all, really no cost. So I can say that there's a skill set for certain types of immigration professionals, and the economic class is quite different than the refugee.
Now, there's no guarantee for people who are walking this path in the hopes that they'll be able to move to Canada. As you think about some of the risk factors from the beginning of that application to they've got their permanent residency, they're here, they've landed, they're good. What are some of the pitfalls or risk factors that could have the dollars that they spend be put at risk? And maybe it's the dollars they spend, or maybe it's their ability to earn an income. Like, what are some of the mistakes that could be made or challenges that people could face?
Well, there's two points to that. The first point people need to know, and they already do know, that the general rules for the masses of highly skilled, it's based on a scoring system. And the scoring system that is used changes on every single period where they announce an invitation for a series of applicants. So that score fluctuates. And the score fluctuates based on how many people are in the pool and how many come out of the pool every single day of the week, because it's the profile of a candidate is valid for 1 year. So if you don't have the right score, you can improve your score by perhaps getting a job in Canada. So certain professionals like our firm actually has great reach into the labor shortages across 10 jurisdictions in Canada, and we can make a difference for many people who need that extra pointage to get into the country. But there's no guarantee, especially if you, let's say, hire a surgeon, you hire a dentist, you're not getting guarantees of result, and no professional can offer that. But here's another area where there is great variance in the success rate. When someone claims I'm a highly skilled software engineer, you have to be able to document all your evidence. And there are many instances where they can't really procure the right wording of what they did in the past. So it's very difficult for them to go back to the employer from 4 years ago and say, look, I really need an updated letter. It's not so clear. Right. And that, you know, like we have current cases where we have working for employers, the employment contract says consultant, and they're a software engineer, but the title is says consultant. Well, consultant is just not going to work. So we have to go back and look at that letter. And very often candidates applying into the system don't have the evidence of what they did with concrete matching of what the government is looking for. And that is, there's a lot of gray zone work in that space. And that's where a professional who's in the field knows what to do.
One last question. We talked about the consultant world and the questions about the efficacy of those services. Are there any other, I'd call it scams, like I'll use that word by design just to put a fine point on it. Are there any other scams that people who are pursuing a life here in Canada that they should watch out for?
Well, it's very common for some of these organizations overseas to be working remotely or having someone come in. And what they do is they ghost consult. The field of ghost consulting is very prevalent, where someone works in the field, claims to have an expertise, not licensed, obviously charges a much lower fee. The buyer is interested in it. And what they do is they have the buyer, the client, point and click on certain buttons to create the different submissions that need to be done. So they'll guide the buyer to make these, upload documents and create profiles. But obviously there's a consensual relationship going on. Someone says, look, I'm willing to pay you a few $100. You seem to know what you're doing. It's not blindly going in. Most of these cases where they're claiming that they were not aware is very unlikely. I think people who are involved in these relationships know very well that they've made an overt choice to work with an unlicensed professional. And, it's pretty easy to prove the credentials on the Canadian side. So there's a wide range of unlicensed and lower fees that some applicants are attracted to.
Very interesting. Colin, thanks for your time and for your insight today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Colin Singer, an immigration lawyer and founder of immigration.ca. He was here to talk about the costs associated with making the move from somewhere else to Canada. Credit Canada has made a huge, huge effort to support newcomers this financial literacy month. And that's played out in lots of different ways. We've done lots of events. We've got webinars. We've got all sorts of things online, blog posts. But the thing that I am proudest of in terms of the work that our team has done is an e-learning platform called Building Credit from the Ground Up. And it is a program for newcomers. It is available in 8 different languages, English, French, Arabic, Farsi, Hindi, Spanish, simplified Chinese, and Tagalog. And it's basically e-learning on any device. So you start these modules. They take under 15 minutes. They have case studies and quizzes and all that. And they cover the essentials of credit, how to build your credit history, how to get a credit card, how to improve your credit score. And module number four, particularly relevant, you never want to have to be in this circumstance, but what do you do if you run into problems with your credit? This e-learning material is available at creditcanada.com/newcomers, creditcanada.com/newcomers, and all of it is completely free. Stay with us. Coming up later on Moolala, the reasons why we take financial risks. The human brain is endlessly fascinating. Our guest, Elise Paison-Lunestour from the University of South Wales. But first, the financial challenges families face when they have a child with an unexpected illness. Kate Horton, CEO of Ronald McDonald House Charities Canada, will be here to talk about some of those challenges and the support that is out there to help families deal with them. I am the money columnist for CityLine, which is a daily lifestyle show. We talk about all sorts of things that are affecting families these days. And boy, there's a lot to choose from. So I have context on the circumstances that we find ourselves in today, tips, tricks on spending, on earning, on slashing debt. CityLine.tv is the URL of the website.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
The illness of a child changes a family immediately and in so, so many different ways. Emotionally, and of course, in the context of our program, financially too. Ronald McDonald House is a national charity that helps families during these really, really tough times. For more on this question of the financial implications, we're joined by Kate Horton. She is the CEO of Ronald McDonald House Charities Canada. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Great to be with you. Thanks so much for the opportunity to spend some time with you today.
Our pleasure. We're going to talk about the financial toll, but we can't do that without the context. Mm-hmm. Can you describe some of the circumstances in which families come to your doors?
Sure. I think, thank you for asking. It's a great place to start our conversation today. You know, when your child is seriously ill or injured, there's no other way to say it, Bruce, your whole world changes in a nanosecond. And I think back to actually just yesterday, I was spending time with the Morris family, whose world was turned upside down when they were expecting their first child, a happy event in anyone's life. And at 24 weeks, baby Jack unexpectedly arrived. He was 910 grams, a micro preemie. And Danielle and Tyler Morris spent the next 208 nights living at the Ronald McDonald House in Hamilton, Ontario, while Jack, a little warrior, received essential treatment, fought for his life, and ultimately came through to the other side, and I'm happy to say is thriving today. But that is a journey that Danielle and Tyler will say, you know, they did not anticipate. All of a sudden, their world was turned upside down. They were forced to leave their home community to travel to a specialized pediatric hospital that was more than an hour away from their home, their jobs, their support network, friends and family, and really face an unknown world at a critical and deeply challenging time.
They had an hour to travel. I am sure you have many, many stories of people for whom an hour would be a dream. They would like have to hop on a plane in order to get the care that their child needed. We don't have pediatric hospitals in every single corner of this country. How dire a situation is it for people who don't live anywhere near driving distance? to those facilities?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good news story for patients. And, you know, the good news in Canada is we have 16 incredible pediatric children's hospitals who do wonderful work, really driving the best outcomes for their young patients. And that's a real point of pride, I think, in terms of our healthcare system. And we are at RMHC incredibly proud to partner with those pediatric hospitals coast to coast to coast. What many Canadians are surprised to learn is that, in fact, as you said, Bruce, you know, 65% of our population lives outside a city with a children's hospital. And so that means for families like the Morris family, travel is not optional. It's essential. And as you said, sometimes over long distances, sometimes over a medical journey, it could be, you know, traveling from center to center to multiple hospitals, depending on how a child's situation evolves. So it is an unexpected reality for many families across the country today, and something that unless you're in that situation yourself or you know someone who is in that situation, not something we would typically realize.
How able are families able to access a vacancy at a Ronald McDonald House? I mean, we just think about real estate in this country. You can't find a rental. You can barely get an Airbnb. I am sure you run into capacity constraints.
We do. You know, we are so grateful to have the opportunity to serve on an average year over 26,000 families at RMHC across the country. And we provide a place to stay just steps away from each one of those 16 specialty children's hospitals. And in addition to accommodations, Bruce, we provide support that helps to alleviate the emotional and the financial burden of caring for a sick child, like meals, laundry service, mental health and wellness programming, a caring community of support for families who are staying with us. But what is really grounding for us is that today we are only meeting an estimated 20% of overall need for RMHC across Canada due to lack of space. And that really means, when you think about it, to your point, we are unable to support 4 out of 5 families who need our services. So we have an ambitious goal to double our capacity in the next 10 years. And that will, in addition to providing more accommodation for families in need, it will also provide those families with essential financial relief by helping them save in lots of out-of-pocket expenses during their time that they're healing their sick child.
I want to telegraph out from two of the key costs that you focus squarely on, travel and accommodation, and look at other things like, you know, medical devices, that drugs that aren't covered on insurance. I know this isn't directly what you deal with, but you have families who are, I'm sure, in your lobby just wrestling with how they fund these ancillary costs. What do you do? Yeah. How do you help them navigate that?
Well, and I think we can all agree, no one should have to choose between their job and healing their sick child, or their family's economic future and healing their sick child. And so we did some work with RBC in this space, Bruce, to your point, and we looked at a new RBC economic impact study that our partners at the bank generously supported and built for us. And we learned through that study that families in Canada now need up to $20,000 in the first month alone to be by the side of their sick child. And just to give you some context, that $20,000 represents approximately 26% of an Ontario family's annual disposable income, and would take that average family up to 5.5 years to pay back. And that's just for 1 month. And we know because of those medical advances that treatments in general are taking longer, over longer periods of time, more frequent stays, sometimes repeat stays over a decade or more. And so the reality is today that having a sick child can be financially devastating. And so nationally, RMHC across Canada saves families today nearly $57 million in annual expenses in all those places that you called out, Bruce, you know, hotel, parking, laundry, food, other essentials. And when we think about that growth goal that we have in mind to double our capacity, that will generate an additional $52 million a year in savings. So that's why we're pushing to grow, is to help and be there for families emotionally and also financially when they need it most.
That is a jaw-dropping number. 20 grand in a month. It's a jaw-dropping number. We've talked about some of the variables, but surely there's ones we've missed here, because travel and accommodation can't add up to that number. What are the key ones that we haven't talked about yet?
Yeah, parking. You know, the reality is specialty pediatric hospitals are typically located in urban centers where hotel accommodations or alternate accommodations, parking, food are at a premium. Transportation, laundry, you know, the meal programs that we provide, Bruce, at RMHC have really exploded. And we're actually finding more need, and we're providing more meals for families today in 2023 than we were before the pandemic. Wow. And that's related to the escalating costs of food, food availability, and in some cases, food insecurity, even within the hospital, where cafeterias and so on have closed down over the last few years and not reopened, or are providing limited options or limited hours for families who just can't leave bedside. And so we're really active in the space of providing a hot and nutritious meal in the Ronald McDonald House for families when they come home at the end of a long day, but also providing frozen meals prepared that are easy to zap at 3 a.m. or whenever you need one. Grab and go meals. So, you know, take a healthy meal with you in your lunch bag when you go over to the hospital for the day. And that's really been a space where we're seeing increased demand, and naturally, I think, as everybody is in these times, increased cost.
The income piece is enormous and would be different according to family, depending on the income that they were bringing in before a diagnosis. What are the best in class companies doing to accommodate this this reality for their employees? And what's the, on the other end of the spectrum, what do most people deal with when they say to their boss, hey, yeah, I'm punching out here because I have a life to save?
Right. You know, I think particularly coming out of the last few years and what we've all lived through, I think there's a new understanding of the importance of family and caregiver presence, and being able to take time to be present for loved ones of any age when, you know, they need support and caregiving support. And so, you know, I do think optimistically there is across society a new level of understanding of the importance of taking that time and ensuring that presence. And I know many employers are supportive in terms of caregiver leave programs and so on. I think the other reality is that for so many you know, Canadians across the country who are entrepreneurs, self-employed, running their own businesses, that's just part of their reality of sort of, you know, running their own shop. And so in that case, what we try to do at RMHC is provide business centers, workstations, remote work facilities and options so that those families who are trying to manage their business while, you know, supporting their family have some option and support to, you know, keep that going. And we have heard from families who are entrepreneurs and running their own business that sort of bridging support from RMHC allows them to keep in touch with their core business, their income, and keep their business moving while also being present for families and in many cases siblings who also need to travel, you know, to keep that family whole while they're going through an incredibly difficult time.
Kate, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce, for the opportunity to share our story. And I would just close by saying, you know, for anybody who wants to know more about how Ronald McDonald House across Canada supports families, please do visit our website at rmhc.ca. And there's lots of options there and information around not just our programs and impact, but how you can get involved.
Kate Horton is the CEO of Ronald McDonald House Charities Canada, and we were talking about the unbelievable financial toll, in addition to all the emotional impacts, but the financial toll of having a child who is unwell. They had a RBC impact, economic impact report that highlighted the cost in the first month alone was $20,000. Unimaginable. Coming up, our next guest says that all humans take mindless risks. Okay, but why? Why do we do this? Elise Paysan-Lenestour has done a lot of research on this. She joins us next to explain. And to stay up to date on all things Moolala, sign up for our newsletter at moolala.ca.
We all believe in the possibilities of tomorrow. And at Easy Financial, we're here to help you every step of the way. If the banks aren't an option, we can help get you approved for a loan in as little as 10 minutes. And with our personal, home equity, and auto loans, you can choose the loan that's right for you, so you can start rebuilding your credit for a better tomorrow. Apply today without affecting your credit score at easyfinancial.com or at over 400 locations and find out how much you can qualify for. Easy Financial. Better tomorrows.
It's fair to say that money and risk are inextricably linked in so many ways. No risk, no reward. You've heard the phrase. So many of the decisions we make include an element of risk. They could be super obvious, like you're playing the slots in Vegas. Of course, you know you're taking a risk. And there are things that we might describe as super safe bet, like, you know, buying a house. Well, it was safe until interest rates started their march higher and people realized that they actually did indeed take a risk when they bought that house. Elise Paysan-Lenestour has done extensive research on risk and on behavioral finance. She's an associate professor of finance at the University of South Wales in Sydney, and her research looks at the ways people perceive and react to financial risks. She joins us now from Australia to talk about her findings. Hello there.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today.
It is our pleasure. You are on our radar in part because of a fantastic TED Talk you delivered a number of years ago on this broad topic. We will get into the details, but I first want to ask you how one even goes about approaching the study of risk. Do you go to Las Vegas, as I mentioned, and sit behind the retiree pulling a slot machine with a clipboard? Is that basically, did I just sum up your life's work in a sentence?
Oh, no, actually. Anthropologists do that. Natasha Schull is my favorite example. She did exactly what you've just described. No, what I do is, it's different. It's complementary. I do experiments in the lab. So I recruit human beings. I could do it with monkeys as well, but for now, just humans. And put them in the lab and have them participate in some risk-taking tasks, see how they behave, collect data, a lot of data, and then see whether interesting statistical behavioral patterns emerge, and then try to understand, to flesh out, you know, the root causes of what you observed.
What are some of the hypotheses that you are testing in your research? What are some of the questions that you're trying to answer?
So my recent research, what motivated me was to really try to understand the root causes of irrational risk taking. What I mean by that is when you observe some seemingly puzzling behavior whereby the person who is, you know, purportedly intelligent, and yet the person is going to take reckless risks. That is, risks that are, I mean, taking gambles that are not worth the risks objectively. What I mean is, you compute expected value, it's clearly negative, the risks are significant. And so you wonder, okay, why is this? I mean, why is this person taking a risk, exposing herself to massive losses? And it's not worth the risk objectively. And my motivation was to try to run experiments in the lab to uncover the root causes of this paradox.
What are some of the things that you found?
So what I found is that the usual suspect to explain why many of us actually sometimes take reckless risks is, so the usual suspect is what? Well, you said it at the beginning. It's faulty cognition, right? The fact that we are unaware of a true risk. So, you know, we at Gilu did that. The risks are much, much smaller than actual. We are deluded that the expected value of what we're doing is positive, even when objectively it's not. And the usual suspect is very often, you know, the main reason why we are doing this. But what I discovered is that it is not the only reason that people engage in irrational gambling. Another reason is that we human beings, we are greedy and lack self-control. And what I mean by greed is I refer to our neurobiology, the dopamine system of the human brain. Mm. Makes us seek rewards. And something that I found, or I should say, it's not found, it's provided evidence for, is that in gambling context, we human beings, we may crave monetary rewards in the same way that we crave primary rewards, such as food, for example. You know? So that's, I mean, an interesting, I think, finding because again, the usual, the standard explanation, which is, by the way, very valid, is that, well, you know, we don't understand what we're doing. Well, no, yes, but not sometimes this is not the reason why we're doing it. And here, the right analogy is diet. Many, if not most of us, we know how we should be eating to be healthy, yet we often succumb to binging on sugary foods. And my research suggests that, well, in financial investing, it may well be the same thing, which is
how do you factor in neurodiversity? And I ask because a neurotypical human would have certain behaviors that probably hover around the mean. And there are people who have ADHD, for example, and they have impulsive behavior that that affects them in life in so many ways, in terms of what they say out loud when it may not be appropriate, in terms of how fast they drive a car or jump off a diving board. And we see in the nonprofit credit counseling world, a lot of people who take risky steps with their money have a root cause that is connected to neurodiversity, or another example would be mental health. How do you factor that in to your findings?
Also, that's, yeah, so you're spot on. That's very important, actually, to understand that there's a massive inter-individual heterogeneity. That is, we are not equally vulnerable to a plague that I've just mentioned, this craving thing. And that's a very important point to make indeed. So what I mean is, and I like that you mentioned the ADHD example. So because as you know, it's something that is fairly common in the population, but so it's not abnormal in that sense. It's not like, you know, a disease, not at all. And so somebody exhibiting, you know, ADD syndrome is more susceptible to the craving thing, while somebody who is whose makeup is different in the sense that, just to give you a funny example, so I am OCD, so meaning that it's, you would say, well, to summarize, it's a bit simplistic, but you would say it's a symmetrical of ADD in the sense that you tend to be super, well, not impulsive, but quite the reverse, you know? So you would really be super rigid, but paying in attention to focusing for hours with no problem. And so anyway, so meaning that the CEO of my brain, my prefrontal cortex, is pretty good at controlling things. And I'm a big control freak, by the way. So compared to the typical ADD person, it's quite the opposite. Part of the issue with ADHD is that the CEO of the brain is not fully able to control things. And so that's, you know, so somebody with ADHD person is going to be way more vulnerable to the greed factor that I described before, relative to somebody like me. So I would be significantly less susceptible to the plague. So moral of the story is that self-awareness is really important, because so what I mean is talking about the average person, which by the way I did at the beginning when I talked about this grid thing and blah blah blah. Yeah, okay, on average, but self-awareness is key, because again, some of us are more vulnerable than others.
Another dimension that I want to layer in and get your take on is one's lived experience. So you could have a young person who grew up in deep poverty, and as they move forward in their life, they behave in a way that is maybe very risk averse because of the circumstances of their upbringing, or very risk tolerant because they're like, what do I have to lose here? I may as well just throw it all at the wall because it can't get any worse than it was when I was 12. What do you observe in the way people were parented and the way they were raised in those formative years?
So what recent research suggests, not mine, by the way, because I didn't research on that topic, but from reading the literature, yeah, I think the most insightful field is the epigenetics, in genomics. The recent there has been a revolution recently, in the sense that the take-home message is that our genetic code per se is not that important, because what matters the most is your early life experiences, the environment in which you were grown. And so the idea being, just to explain it intuitively, basically your body is going to adjust to the predicted environment. So if it's as if metaphorically your body can anticipate, in which world am I going to live in? And so imagine that early on in life, just to follow up on your example, so the individual lives in an environment that is characterized by a lot of poverty. So let's say deprivation. And then the body's going to adjust to that by anticipating, oh gosh, it's going to be tough. And this could trigger modifications in gene expression, in the sense that, for example, this is a hypothesis, but that's, I mean, what has been suggested by recent work, that could make the agent, for example, more risk tolerant, in the sense that if there is a reward opportunity that crops up, it may be rational for the agent to just, jump at all risks, because again, if a body has anticipated that, oh boy, I'm gonna live in it's gonna be total deprivation, I do need to find out reward sources to survive, and so that could trigger changes in the genetic makeup of the individual, in the sense that gene expression is gonna be modified in such a way that, in my example, the agent is gonna be more risk tolerant, and so that's one way to summarize this epigenetic dynamic. So if you want, it's about really like reprogramming our genes such that we are adapted to our current environment, the environment we live in. That's basically how it's, how it works.
I want to ask one last question before we go. I am fascinated by all this. It's like intellectual candy for me. And as an academic, you can pursue questions really for the pursuit of the question and the knowledge and the insight. But there is also so much in what you research and what you write about that is incredibly applicable to the average human in terms of understanding themselves and at best modifying behavior in a way that serves their future self. If you were to, this is an impossible question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you were to boil all of this down into one takeaway that you would wrap up and gift to mm-hmm. our listeners as a piece of advice that they could apply, what would it be?
I think it would probably be, if we're talking to financial investors, I would say, don't focus too much on what you're going to be told by some behavioral finance people telling you that, oh, you know, people are stupid. So the reason that you take insane risks often is because it's lack of intelligence. And don't just be aware that, no, there are other reasons. And I would like people to focus more on the, you know, this greed thing and this. Mm. I think it's an important idea that often we do silly things in terms of, you know, risk taking. It simply reflects how our brain was wired. It's about our neurobiology, and we can do something about it so long as we are aware of that. And again, here I like the food analogy because I believe it's highly relevant here. Again, we, you know, many of us, we know what we should be doing, yet we often succumb to binging, and it's the same thing in financial investing. And I do believe that this very simple idea is not something that is well known, because again, both behavioral finance research in the past and also, I shall add, pop psychology notions as well, converge toward this idea that, oh, you know, people will be stupid. It's like, you know, this Homer Simpson, you know, picture. And,
yeah.
I would say, wait. It is often true, but definitely not always. And there are other root causes as to why we take insane risk. And I would like people to focus a bit more on, you know, this aspect, the greed.
Very helpful. The greed. Ugh, I'm afraid that's our time, Elise. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Many thanks for your interest in the research.
Merci. Elise Pézanne-Nestour is an associate professor of finance at the University of South Wales in Sydney. She joins us today from Australia in a very different time zone. Greed or no greed, that is our show for today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, Easy Financial, personal home equity and auto loans with personalized rates and terms for you, Indeed Canada, the number one job site worldwide, number one source of hire here in Canada, and the Canadian Bankers Association, the voice of 60 domestic and foreign banks. We also are grateful for the support of Achieve, a leading charitable organization that delivers many different services, including services for newcomers in the Greater Toronto Area. What did you think about the show today? I thought we covered some really interesting ground. If you would like to send us some feedback, a story idea, a question, whatever it is, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. To keep up to date on all things Moolala, you can subscribe to our newsletter. You'll be able to do that, moolala.ca. And for the podcast version of the show, you can go and, you know, find it on any of the platforms out there. While you're there, subscribe and review. On social media, I'm @BruceSellery on X, BruceSellery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.